Welcome to Journeys Through Pulmonary Fibrosis, a podcast of Boehringer Ingelheim. My name is Steve Jones. I was an IPF patient. I had a lung transplant a few years ago, and I'm currently the president of the European Pulmonary Fibrosis Federation, which brings together 22 patient organizations from 19 countries across Europe. I'm joined tonight by two extraordinary people who have leading roles to play in patient organizations. And during the talk tonight, we're going to talk on about patient organizations, about what patient organizations do, and about hope and resilience and how we move together as an IPF, a pulmonary fibrosis family. So first, if I could turn to John and to Scott, my two guests, and ask you each to introduce yourself, perhaps tell us just a little bit about the organization you work for and your links to pulmonary fibrosis.
Certainly. So my name is Scott Stalzik, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer for the Pulmonary Fibrosis Foundation, which is based in Chicago, Illinois, in the United States. The organization has been around for approximately 23 years, and my role there is with oversight of programs such as education, awareness, advocacy, research. I also oversee some of our corporate fundraising and in partnerships.
And John?
Hi, my name is John Solheim. I am serving on the board of directors together with Steve in the European Pulmonary Fibrosis Federation. And in addition to that, I am also organized in the Norwegian Patient Organization for Heart and Lung Patients. So basically, I have IPF, so I am a patient and a volunteer.
Okay, Scott, would you like to tell us a little bit about your job and your links to pulmonary fibrosis?
Certainly. I've been at the foundation nearly 13 years. I started in January of 2011. I originally joined as the chief financial officer, and then in 2015, I transitioned into the chief operating officer role. Had the luxury of also serving twice now as the interim CEO through different leadership changes. When I started at the foundation, I was unaware of the disease. I was recruited for my professional skills more so to lead the organization down a new path and grow it. But 3.5 years into my time at the foundation, approximately July of 2014, my mother was diagnosed with idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, which was stunning to our family.
Yeah, so you grew a direct connection to it.
Yes, it firmed up the reason that I was at the foundation, and it gave me an inside perspective of what patients experience and also caregivers and family members. So I use those experiences in my day-to-day work all the time.
So all three of us around the table have lived experience of living with fibrosis, yeah. John, tell me about your job and your links to the disease. And
So I apply some of my time to both the national organization to doing peer support, which I think is extremely important. Also running a closed Facebook group for patients and carers. That's the national. And then I also said that, okay, we're a small community. We need also then to have influences from the outside. So that's why I've chosen to be on the European level as well. Because then, given the fact that we're so few, we need a broader area to collect and share information.
That's great. I look at you in awe, actually, John, because I think back to when I lived with pulmonary fibrosis, I couldn't have done what you're doing. In terms of, you know, keeping, being that energetic, you know, that focused, that hardworking as you are, what drives you, what motivates you to, you could be going fishing or something. Why are you doing this?
I'll tell you what, in my journey started in 2009 with actually a radiologist who was spot on and two pulmonologists in a row for the next 3 years that were not spot on. So I actually didn't get my diagnosis until 2018. That meant that I made a conscious decision, or two conscious decisions. One, get engaged, because if my contribution can then prevent somebody else from having that same journey that I had, it's worth it. And also get engaged to be active, because being active in that way, it actually gives a lot. It gives a lot back to yourself. It actually has a tremendous impact on the disease as well.
Great. Well, we're very grateful that you do the work you do, I say. But Scott, I mean, why did you? I believe you were working in the museum sector and in Chicago, and then you decided to move across to a patient organization. What? Why? What was the excitement of doing that?
Well, in my 20s, I was a social worker. I worked approximately 6 years with adults with developmental disabilities and mental illness. So I was always wired in the way to want to help others and have the work that I do be altruistic. So when this opportunity was presented to me, I learned quickly what the disease was and the impact it had on people's lives and thought it would be a very meaningful way to spend a significant portion of my days at work and doing something that is trying to just make people's lives better.
Great. And John, how about you? What does your work involve with your Norwegian group?
Because I'm a part of something a lot bigger. The Norwegian Patient Organization for Heart and Lung Patient is actually covering a lot of disease areas. It's heart, lung, it's stroke, and it's aphasia, or the inability to speak after, yeah. So basically, I'm representing only a small part of it. But there we have a lot of different initiatives. I always say that when you are diagnosed with a severe diagnosis like this, you should have two things leaving the doctor's office. One is a prescription for a patient organization, and the second is a prescription for pulmonary rehabilitation. So basically, I do a lot. I do peer support on telephone. That means that you can call into a central hotline on between 10 o'clock in the morning and 9 o'clock at evening and get to talk to patients within the same situation as you.
Right. So you're a volunteer, don't you?
Yes, yeah. Of course, yes.
I notice that you've got something written on the back of your coat.
Yes.
And you've got the initials LHL on the front.
Yes.
What does that stand for?
That stands for the Norwegian National Patient Organization for Heart and Lung Patients and several other diseases.
Okay. And then on your back, you've got the words likperson or like person.
Like person is actually the translation. It translates to equal person. An equal person is that somebody who can relate to what you're going through. So the Norwegian Organization of Heart and Lung Patients, we have like persons in hospitals, in local communities, and on a national hotline. What they do is they are either carers or mostly patients, so patient can call in or get in a conversation with a patient with the same disease or a relating disease as you. And we actually have 800 like persons all over the country.
John, I've noticed you're coughing. Is it, how bad is it for you? How is living with this debilitating cough?
It is actually quite severe. And for those of you listening to this out there and thinking, this guy, he is not coughing a lot. You're right. And I have my small tricks and tips to avoid that in a session like this, where that would be really disruptive. For instance, there are certain cough-reducing medications, so I have taken that before this session. I also take some time before we start to sit down, relax, and get all my bearings, because then I tend to cough less. So basically, you need to adapt and keep tips and tricks. But if my wife is listening to this, she would say, he's not coughing at all. What's happening? Because she's used to it.
I mean, I know when I had IPF, I had a very bad cough, very productive. I mean, it's really tough, isn't it?
Yes. Let me give you an everyday example. My wife loves the opera, and I've accompanied her many times. I don't anymore, because I do not want to put either her or the other people in the opera to spoil their enjoyment. So that is, the kids are luckily also interested, so they so she takes them instead. It's really, for somebody who doesn't cough constantly, you can't imagine how it's like.
And it's worse in the morning. It's difficult to get going. It's,
it's my sanctuary. I have a sanctuary time. And now I'm getting a little private because this is before I get out of bed. When I wake up, I have a sanctuary time in bed before I get out of bed because I know that as soon as I put this foot on the floor, I will start coughing.
I think people often, you know, we live with breathlessness with pulmonary fibrosis, which is clearly, you know, the thing we monitor, the thing we're most worried about. But the thing that actually affects our quality of life is the cough, I think.
Yes.
It's really,
totally agree.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring that up. A number of years ago, we did a survey amongst patients and asked them what was the worst part of living with the disease, and they said cough, not breathlessness.
And regarding to cough, in respect to breathlessness, I think breathlessness you can, to a certain degree, hide, and that may, in the face of the public, but you can't hide cough.
Yeah.
So it's like broadcasting you're a sick person.
And in a world of COVID, people think you're coughing because of COVID.
The only, only good thing is that you will have a lot of space in the supermarket.
Great, thank you. Yeah. So, John, in our work, we have successes and we know we face many challenges. But if we go with the successes first, looking at the work of in Norway, looking at the work of the Federation, the European Federation, what do you think are our best successes that we've achieved so far?
I think on different levels, I think that the network we built with the healthcare professional community and also both in Europe and in Norway, because, there are several reasons, but we have a good access to the healthcare community as well. And that is a key challenge because I like to think that everybody is really in their bubble. Their informational bubble, seeing things in within a certain perspective, either it's the industry, healthcare professionals, or patient organizations. So we need to find the overlap where we can learn from each other. So that's probably one of the biggest successes, I think.
Yeah, indeed, that's great. So what would you pull out as the 2 to 3 main successes?
Yeah, that's going to be a challenging one to answer. I'm going to anger someone by leaving something out, but I'll attempt here. So similar to John's response, we created a care center network program across the United States. We launched that in 2013 with 9 pilot centers, and over time it's grown. In fact, yesterday we issued a press release adding 7 more centers to it. So now we're at a total of 88. And those new 7 are not large academic medical centers. They're more community-based to help us address issues for people in more rural settings. And so the efforts of this network are immense. We've had some of the membership participate in a registry that we collected data on patients along with blood samples and HRCT images. And that's been used for a plethora of research, which I can speak to a little bit later. But also, we've used the strength of the network, whether that's the physicians or the nursing staff or respiratory therapists, et cetera, to help us put together position statements and work on our educational content. It's all volunteer-based, all of these people across the care center network. And finally, the value of that network is that we know that they have certain resources in providing care and expertise in providing that care to patients. So when a patient goes to one of those centers, they're most likely going to get a far better quality of care than they would in a community-based setting.
So the care centers are essentially the pulmonary fibrosis centers of excellence.
That's correct.
Across the country, yeah? And I mean, for you now is where you are, an organization that's growing, still growing fast, yeah? I mean, you're expanding every year. What are the main challenges you see in the next 2 to 3 years? Yeah.
So some of the challenges that I see are, first of all, the drug development pipeline is stronger than it's ever been. And so finding enough patients to participate in these trials is a challenge. And so we as an organization are trying to do everything we can to compel people to participate. But additionally, some trials aren't designed well. and the burden on the patient is too great, or the exclusion and inclusion criteria is too difficult to find people. So that is definitely a challenge for us. An additional challenge, of course, for any organization is always aspirations versus reality. How much revenue do you have and what can you achieve with it? Because of the needs of this patient community, and we have a lot to do still, there's never enough money to do the things that you can dream up.
Absolutely.
So when, I mean, what Scott was just talking about, particularly clinical trials, you know, needing to educate patients about the importance of research, the importance of participating in clinical trials, working with pharma companies to help them make the trials better earlier, get patients involved from the very early stages. All of that is stuff we work on together. And I think we need to do more as a community because, as you say, I think at the moment there are something over 40 clinical trials going on worldwide in different aspects of pulmonary fibrosis. You know, that's a lot of patients. And we have a big job to do in helping that to fulfill itself. That way we'll get new therapies. Yeah, so John, I mean, when we look at the challenges that we face in Europe, how do you see that now improving the lives of patients and their families and looking to the future, new therapies?
Especially awareness and quality information. Those are two key areas. And not just quality information for patients, but also for physicians and professional healthcare professionals.
Great. So that's a real key issue. I mean, that must be similar in Scott, in America.
It is. So earlier I mentioned that we now have 88 care center network sites across the U.S., but that is only a fraction of the patients who are being treated and cared for in the U.S. I think it's probably between 10 to 12% of the patient population. And so we know those patients are being exposed to educational content and being made aware of the disease and how to live with it better. But the majority of the patients in the U.S. are still being seen in more community settings or even rural settings, and they're not being provided the educational content that they need. And so they're just kind of left alone, and they flounder. They don't know how to survive and live with the disease in a successful way.
That's great. Here we are, three of us from different countries around the world, all focused on pulmonary fibrosis passionately. And yet, Scott, we don't talk to each other enough, do we? I mean, we don't work well enough together. I get this is my sense. What do you feel?
I would agree. One could easily say, well, we're all so busy that it's hard to find time, but that's not a reasonable excuse. I think that the time that we've spent together over the last few days underscores the need for us to have more regularly scheduled dialogue, because if we don't make this a situation where we're regularly speaking with one another, time will just pass. I think there's a lot of opportunity for us to all learn from one another, and I also think the power of union, for us to all join hands. And there are things that globally we can speak to and represent the patient community, and there'll be more power if we all are working together. So for example, we've run a registry in the United States, and the first arm of that was a clinical registry, which is very expensive to run because you have to pay for all those collection costs, et cetera. But July of 2022, we launched a self-reported community registry that patients, lung transplant recipients, family members, and caregivers can all participate. And it would be fantastic if we could replicate this in other countries so that we could start asking universal questions amongst a larger cohort and understand how the disease is impacting people, what are the commonalities and what are the variances.
Yeah. How do you feel about the working cross borders, John?
No, I love it because, again, we're few. We're not that many. And if we're not that many, we can stay not that many and create little data, or we can move across borders and start exchanging views and ideas and then really working together and then pulling back to our corners again and present the results of our findings.
I have another comment on that too. So since there are limited resources globally for us financially, when one of us goes and creates a piece of content that can be translatable to another country, why build that again in waste resource? That money can be used in a smarter way. And so that's what I would like to see, better collaboration for all of us, so that the limited funds that we all have access to, we're maximizing them.
That's great, yeah. I mean, in the European Federation, we also translate all our key documents into, you know, between 5 and 8 other languages. All webinars are summarized in a 10-minute video with subtitles in those languages. But you're right, it's hugely expensive. So the more we can work together on that, the better. So going forward, I mean, you each have really making major contributions by managing and making patient organizations work for the benefit of others. What's the most rewarding aspect of your job, John?
That is the patient feedback. No doubt about it.
And Scott, your most rewarding aspects of your job?
I would say the overarching rewarding aspect is most of the time when people come to us, they'd never heard of the disease before. They've received this diagnosis, they're scared, they're confused by it. And through their engagement with us, whatever that may be, they become more educated and they reduce their anxiety. And that knowledge is power. And you can see this transformation in people, and I'm sure you see it also in the people you work with. And then to see some of them become activists and want to help others. And that's really humbling for me, because I don't have to live with this disease. When someone like John is choosing to spend his time to help others and educate people and improve their quality of life, when they could just say, well, I don't know how much more time I have, it seems quite limited, and I'm going to just use that time for myself. I wouldn't fault anyone for that, but it's humbling to work with people who give so much of themselves under such circumstances.
It's interesting, because I work as a volunteer too, and I often, some people have said to me, you know, you've had a transplant now 5 or 7 years ago, you know, why do you still do this? Why don't you get on and play golf or do other things that old people do? And I thought about it, and I thought, well, the reason is that if I die tomorrow from complications of lung transplant, I'm not dying from lung transplant. I'm dying because of pulmonary fibrosis, the thing that caused the lung transplant, and I'm still part of the community. And we are a community, and we work together, and it doesn't stop for me. And there are so many people like me, you know, the same post-transplant, who continue to work for the PF community. And I think it's humbling, isn't it, when we come across so many other people doing that. Okay, bring it slowly, you know, to a close now. I mean, you know, the question I often end these things with is, if you were to come face-to-face now with a patient newly diagnosed, what would your message be for them?
First, I would make sure that they were being cared for at a center that had expertise in the disease. And I would also make sure that they were engaging with the support group. And finally, I would have them align with a patient advocacy organization, such as the PFF or a group in another country, because they're going to be far more informed.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Scott. And John?
Oh, where to start? Because if I meet a patient who's newly diagnosed now, one of the major things I would say that PFF is not a one-person disease. So basically keep your loved ones in the loop. Because if you don't tell them how things really are, they will create their own stories. And believe me, their stories are often worse than what you actually are feeling. So basically, don't over-report or under-report, but tell people how you feel. That is, and keep your loved one in the loop. They're crucial, because they're going to be with you. They have known you from before you got sick. So you can't fool them, even if you try.
Thinking about, you know, a patient who is newly diagnosed, not yet joined a patient organization or a support group, what would you say to them? How would you encourage them to join? What are they going to benefit from if they join?
So if they first attend a support group, they're going to find people who are living the similar experiences. And for some people, it can be perhaps frightening or nervousness to be at a group like that for a couple of reasons. Maybe they're not comfortable sharing their story in a group setting. There could be a cultural reason for that. Or perhaps they feel that it will just be depressing because now they're around a bunch of other sick people and it's a constant reminder of their disease. What they need to understand is that support groups don't have to always just be focused on the negative aspects of living with the disease. In fact, good support groups don't do that. They bring hope and optimism to people, and they bring education to them. And you develop friendships, and you talk with people about things that are well outside of the disease.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I remember the first time I walked into a support group, I was reluctant. I was frightened about seeing myself as an old, sick person. And I went into the room, and everybody was laughing. And people were really welcoming. And it was liberating because everybody in the room understood where I was. So it's transformational for me.
There's a volunteer couple, a husband and wife, that have been working with the PFF for a number of years. And the husband, when he was diagnosed with the disease, he did not want to attend a support group. And his wife said, well, I don't care if you're not going, I'm going. So then he said, well, I can't be that person. I can't let you go and me stay home when I'm the patient. So he ended up going, and they liked it so much that they became the support group leaders.
It's a not uncommon story, I think. And do you agree with that?
Oh, yes, John? Yes. Yeah. And I also agree that when you get into this is a diagnosis which is very serious. It means there are a lot of uncertainty, a lot of fright. And when you get into a support group on a level and you can see that, wow, there are actually people living quite ordinary lives and can do that in a good sense. We know that dark times are coming, but why rush them? So basically, we can inflict you also with the positivity and education, information, all that kind of good stuff.
You know, another thing that I would point out, some people, the support group just may not be for them. Nope. The PFF organizes a number of community events throughout the country. Typically they're walks, but sometimes they're other types of events. And I attend many of those, and I can tell you that I meet a lot of patients at them, and they are just really empowered when they attend it. And so if you can't give enough of your time or a support group isn't for you, that's another way that you could engage and have your voice heard and be part of that greater good. Whether you fundraise or not, just show up to the event because it's also an awareness building activity.
Absolutely. Thanks, John. Thank you, Scott, very much for being with us tonight and sharing some of your personal experiences, which I think we've all found really helpful. I hope those of you at home, thanks also for joining. We hope very much that you've enjoyed this episode of Journeys Through Pulmonary Fibrosis and that you leave us tonight or today feeling more hopeful about the future, because I think we three of us around the table do feel quite hopeful about the future for pulmonary fibrosis patients living with what is a difficult disease. If you'd like to see more episodes of Journeys Through Pulmonary Fibrosis, you can find them where you normally find your podcasts. If you face any difficulties, do get in touch with us at hello@boehringer-ingelheim.com. Get in touch. We'd be happy to give you any information you need. And if you'd like to speak to any of the three of us around the table, we'd be happy to respond to you too. So thank you again for listening. Thank you, John and Scott. Good night.